Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now, our climate story of the week. This week, we'll take a closer look at a confusing duality in the big new climate bill that West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin has now agreed to vote yes on. The duality is that the bill is being hailed as potentially transformative for emission reductions in the United States, and yet it also contains provisions to encourage more production of fossil fuels. What? Here's Senator Manchin on that on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday.
If you're producing more and have more demand, more supply, and that supply drives basically satisfies demand, and then the prices come down because there's more people shopping for the products, that's all. That's capitalism. Yeah. That's who we are.
Which is why the bill is called the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, not the Climate Protection Act of 2022. Let's take a closer look with none other than Bill McKibben, longtime climate activist, co-founder of the climate-focused environmental group, 350.org, a Middlebury College professor, and a New Yorker magazine staff writer. His new article on the New Yorker site says the bill reflects the growing strength of the environmental movement, but also the lingering influence of the fossil fuel industry. Bill, thanks for coming on for this. Always good to have you. Welcome back to WNYC.
Always a pleasure to be with you, friend.
We'll get to some of the contradictions or fossil fuel protections in the bill, but you write that taken as a whole, the bill is a triumph. Why do you use the word triumph?
Well, in the first place, it's mere existence. You know, the U.S. Congress found out before anybody else about climate change. Jim Hansen, from his office at 110th and Broadway, in the 1980s, figured out what was going on in the planet's climate. And in 1988, he went to the U.S. Congress to tell them. And that day in June of 1988 was the kind of launch of the public phase of the global warming era, the first time that really all of us found out what was happening. In the intervening, 34 years, that U.S. Congress has done precisely nothing about climate change. There's never been a major climate bill. The two big attempts in the past, one in the 1990s, the other in 2009 and 10, to pass major legislation, both failed abysmally. This one looked like it was going to fail too. And a couple of weeks ago, almost everybody had given it up for dead. But some credit here to Chuck Schumer and some credit here to the extraordinary environmental advocates at the Sunrise Movement. People kept pushing, and this compromise deal has emerged. It is, as you say, very far from perfect, but it does represent a huge chunk of money going directly where we need it, to renewable energy, to building out sun and wind and batteries, to making buildings more efficient, to putting up EV chargers, basically to providing the bones to build out what's now the cheapest and cleanest form of power on Earth, renewable energy.
And of course, we don't actually know if this bill is going to pass yet. Senator Sinema from Arizona has yet to declare. But you're right that the bill contains hundreds of billions of dollars in tax credits and grants for the transition to solar and wind power, electric vehicles, efficient home heating, and more. Do you know yet if our listeners will be able to take advantage of any of those grants or tax credits as individuals, or if these are all incentives for corporations and governments to transition production to more sustainable fuel sources?
Some of it's for individuals, too. For instance, there's a lot about tax credits for and rebates for electric vehicles. And some of it's very arcane, and some of it depends on, you know, you get more rebates depending on where the vehicle was made and where the ingredients in the battery came from, and on and on and on. So the policy wonks who worked on this, well, they were wonkish. And the hope is, and what all the predictions that anyone's published over the last few days are, that it would allow the U.S. to reduce its emissions by the end of the decade about 40% below what they were in 2005. That's not as much as we need to do, but it's a lot more than we would be doing otherwise.
Listeners, we welcome your questions or comments on our climate story of the week with the legendary Bill McKibben today on the duality of the triumph of the climate provisions in the Inflation Reduction Bill that may now pass Congress, now that Senator Joe Manchin has signed on, and the lingering influence of the fossil fuel industry in the bill. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet your comment or question at Brian Lehrer. So now let's get to some of the fossil fuel protections in the bill. You write, for example, that the bill penalizes oil and gas companies that fail to cut methane emissions, but it doesn't actually pressure energy utilities to abandon coal and gas. Can you explain that duality further, or what the difference is between those two things?
Well, originally this bill, which has gone through a lot of incarnations. I mean, it sort of started out at some level as the Green New Deal, and then it became Build Back Better, and now it's shrunk down to the Inflation Reduction Act. But in its original form, as proposed by Biden, a part of it was called the Clean Energy Performance Plan, and it would have mandated utilities to use renewable energy in ever-increasing amounts. And if they didn't, then they would have had to pay penalties. So there was a stick originally in this. But Joe Manchin took that out a year ago and said, all I want are carrots. And so since they had no other 50th vote, out went the stick and in came the carrots in the form of all these tax credits and things. They won't be as effective as it would have been. But again, the best estimate is that they will allow pretty dramatic reductions in emissions in pretty short periods of time. And I think in the deeper sense, the real hope here is that as we build out renewable energy, it gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. At the moment, each time we double the, say, installed capacity of solar power, the cost drops another 30%. So I think the hope is that once this virtuous cycle gets going full steam, it'll have a real snowball effect. That's the hope anyway. It's going to take tons of vigilance, and it's also going to take people figuring out other ways to stand up to the fossil fuel industry, because as you point out, Manchin was able to negotiate on their behalf a number of incredibly stupid provisions. He's taken more money from the fossil fuel industry than anybody else in D.C., and man, they got their money's worth back in lots of the giveaways and gifts in this bill.
You also cite that for the next decade under this bill, no offshore wind lease can be sold unless an offshore oil and gas lease of a certain size has been sold in the previous year.
I think unless an offshore gas lease has been offered in the previous year.
Offered.
And the hope is...
So what does that mean?
Well, the hope is increasingly that those offers will go untaken. You may recall at the end of the Trump years, he tried very hard to rush through in the last weeks in office, for instance, the right to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But when they put it up for auction, nobody bid, because environmental movements and indigenous people had managed to make that prospect so toxic that no driller and no bank or whatever was willing to go in and say, we're going to be the ones that rip up the Arctic Wildlife Refuge for oil. And we've obviously got to do that same work, you know, with place after place around the world. In fact, that was some of the work that we were about yesterday in New York City with the comptroller Brad Lander, who is beginning to figure out how to mobilize the city's vast portfolio of funds to put pressure on precisely those banks and asset managers to stop fossil fuel expansion. We may not be able to do that in the Senate because we don't have the votes, but we may be able to do it on Wall Street because, well, because blue states and blue cities have a lot of money. And if it's pointed in the right direction, it could be really valuable. So
yeah, props using to those for that. Huge pension funds to put pressure on corporate America to do the right thing by deciding some social standards for those investments. You're right that the political trade-off of this whole bill is worth it in carbon terms, but it will set a problematic example around the world. What's the international implication here?
Well, there's two international implications. The good one, and it's really important, is that the U.S. is back as an actual player, maybe even a leader in the climate fight. This was supposed to happen a year ago. You'll remember there was this huge climate conference in Glasgow. And as the way the script was written, Build Back Better was supposed to pass last fall, and then Joe Biden would fly to Glasgow with this thing in his back pocket and slam it down on the table and say, you know, Russia, China, India, how do you like them apples? You know, match us. Instead, it didn't pass last year, and so Biden showed up with nothing. And that's the biggest reason that conference just fizzled. This year's version, which is set for November in Egypt, will be more interesting than it would otherwise have been, thanks to this new development. But, you know, our insistence that we're going to go on, Manchin's insistence that the U.S. has to go on offering up leases for new oil and stuff, will just, you know, people around the world are going to say, if the U.S. can do that, why can't we? The example I used in that New Yorker piece was Congo, which last week the Democratic Republic of Congo announced that they were going to offer drilling rights across the rainforest, the second biggest rainforest on Earth. This is insane. I mean, not only does it produce lots more oil to add carbon to the atmosphere, it cuts down one of the biggest sinks for carbon on the planet. It's like not only adding fuel to the fire, it's like chopping the fire hose in half. But, I mean, how are we going to tell the Congolese not to do this? The average Congolese produces about 1/500th as much carbon pollution as the average American. And yet, if we can't rein in our appetite to expand this industry, it's a little much to ask that they do so. So there's endless more work to be done here. No doubt.
In that New Yorker piece and your reference to the Congo, you quote Congo's longtime climate representative telling, I guess it was the New York Times last month, that his priority is fighting poverty, not to save the planet. And I wonder if you'd reflect on that for a second as a global tension between worthy goals, you know, anti-climate change and anti-poverty. And if it's different, you think, in the affluent United States than it is in Congo, obviously it's different. But the tension even here is usually framed as between long-term climate protection, which people consider important, and short-term economic pain, like inflation at the gas pumps, which is real economic pain. So does the Manchin-supported bill strike a kind of compassionate balance, or how would you frame it?
Well, here's how I'd think about it. First of all, I mean, look, when one talks about poverty in places like the Congo, the numbers are so incredible that it's hard for us to even sort of imagine what that means. The per capita income is 1/100th of ours. I mean, we're talking, you know, absolute and dire poverty. But the best way, as everyone has now figured out, to deal with that is to not to burn more fossil fuel. That just enriches a few elites in these countries. And if you look across Africa, you see case after case of how it impoverishes even further the whole of the country. But B, renewable energy is what offers a real way out. I wrote a piece for The New Yorker a couple of years ago. I spent a lot of time across both West and East Africa, watching as solar power has now become cheap enough that it can be deployed to start bringing energy for the first time to the billion people around this planet who are still without electricity, still off the grid. Not only does it provide power for them, doing it that way also make sure that people avoid the health effects that come with combustion. You know, that big study last year demonstrated that just breathing the particulates from burning coal and gas and oil kills 9 million people a year on this planet. That's more than COVID. That's more than HIV, AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, war, terrorism combined. I mean, the level of human development that will go with clean, renewable energy is remarkable. And it allows us to think optimistically for once about the future. But we've got to get there, and we've got to get there fast. This bill helps. In the context of the United States or the whole world, look, going to renewable energy fast saves us huge amounts of money. Think about it for a moment. If you power your civilization by burning gas or coal, well, every day you burn up the gas and coal, and you've got to go find some more and pay for it. That costs a lot. If you power your civilization with sun and wind, yeah, it costs some money to put up the wind turbine or the solar panel. But once you've done it, well, the sun delivers the energy for free every morning when it rises above the horizon. That's why the economists say that it would save us trillions and tens of trillions of dollars to rapidly move to a renewable energy economy. And it's also why Exxon et al. Fight it so hard. From their point of view, Brian, that's the stupidest business model on earth. You know, the sun delivering energy for free, you know, who would want that? Not someone who owns an oil well or a coal mine, that's for sure.
Maybe the sun can patent itself. We have a few more minutes on our climate story of the week on the Brian Lehrer Show for this week with Bill McKibben from the Climate Protection Group, 350.org. And he's a New Yorker staff writer, where he wrote in the last few days about the dualities in the bill that looks like will pass the Senate now with Joe Manchin's backing, the duality between the triumph of the climate provisions that are in the bill and the protections for the fossil fuel industry that are also explicitly in the bill. 212-433-WNYC and Tristan in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hi, Tristan. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I had a question about this news that broke yesterday about a side legislation that got Joe Manchin over that would expedite oil and gas projects, and would specifically expedite a project in West Virginia for a new gas pipeline, and just how that fits into this pros cons of this bill and just the general, what feels a little bit like, you know, just free giveaways to the fossil fuel industry.
They absolutely are free giveaways, Tristan. And the Mountain Valley Pipeline seems to have been Manchin's pound of flesh here, or one of them. And they're gross. But that's what happens when you have, you know, when you have a balance of power like we have. The balance of power has gotten better between the climate movement and the fossil fuel industry. That's why there's a bill of any kind instead of nothing like we've had for 34 years. But the balance of power isn't strong enough to do all the things we should be doing. That's why they're still able to get lots of gifts and giveaways. They're very strong. They own one of our political parties. Not a single Republican senator would vote for this thing. And, you know, they own enough of Joe Manchin that they've been, you know, using him as their proxy in this battle. So that's just how it works, you know. And it's why it was so important yesterday to have Brad Lander come out and say, not only was New York going to use its power, its money power, to try and stand up to fossil fuel expansion, but he was going to try and enlist treasurers and comptrollers from other parts of the country. This is really important because that may be a way that we're able to stand up to some of these projects, even the ones that Manchin has managed to get into this bill.
Tristan, thanks for the call. Now, this is the Inflation Reduction Act, we should remember. And we played that Joe Manchin clip at the beginning, arguing it will bring down energy prices by getting more energy into production more quickly. Is any of that from a projected increase in supply of renewables in the short term, not just supply of fossil fuels in the short term?
Yeah, I mean that's the actual increase, the actual inflation reduction that it produces will come precisely because renewable energy is cheaper than fossil energy, and if you get more of it, it should drive down the total price of energy. That's the real hope. You know, going and building out some new oil field, you know, over the next 5 years someplace isn't going to bring down the price of gas at the moment. What will bring down the price of energy is rapid expansion of renewables because it's so much cheaper. Look, we're at a moment when it's actually possible to imagine that our planet's 200,000-year career of our species, 200,000-year career of setting stuff on fire could come to an end. We now know how to take full advantage of this large ball of burning gas that the good Lord hung 93 million miles up in the sky. And if we do that, then the future is, well, the future looks brighter than it did a few days ago.
Nick in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Bill McKibben. Hi, Nick.
Hi. I don't know if Bill McKibben can shed light on this, but I was just wondering why fossil fuel companies, who clearly have the means to do so, haven't invested in alternative energies only because it takes a certain technology to transform solar and hydro and wind into electricity and more practical things that we use. Why don't these companies, take advantage?
It's the perfect question. It's the perfect question, Nick. Especially since we now know from great investigative reporting, companies like Exxon knew all about climate change back in the 1980s, and they could have been, stolen a march on everyone and been the pioneers here. But the reason they didn't has been made pretty clear over time. In fact, their executives have said it. You can make money putting up solar wind power, and plenty of people will become millionaires and billionaires doing it. But you can't make the same kind of money that you can from fossil fuel, just for the reason that I said before, that the sun delivers it for free instead of you having to write a check to Exxon month after month your whole life. And so that's why they've fought so hard to keep it from happening. There was a study that came out last week that showed that over the last 50 years, the fossil fuel industry has made $3 billion a day in profit. It's been the most profitable business. It's riding a boom right now because, Vladimir Putin, with whom most of the big energy companies have done business quite happily for many years, has, with his barbarity, driven up the price of fossil fuel. So they're getting a temporary boom. With any luck, it'll be the last boom that they'll ever get like that. But that's why they not only didn't invest in this stuff, it's why they spent 30 years funding a massive effort to make sure no one else did, to deny climate and to keep us from making these kind of shifts. It's a truly tragic story, and we would be in a completely different place. I mean, look, Brian was joking about it earlier. If there was some way for Exxon to own the sun, they probably would have done this, and maybe we'd be further ahead. But the good news now is Exxon doesn't own the sun. And so when we build out renewable energy, nobody, not Vladimir Putin, not the king of Saudi Arabia, not the Koch brothers, not anybody, will be able to, keep the sun from shining or the wind from blowing.
You can't patent the sun, but there is a solar panel industry and otherwise a solar power industry. There is a wind power industry. Somebody has to make the windmills and the turbines and all of this. And so I think the caller's question even still applies. And for all I know, because I haven't looked into it, the major fossil fuel companies who probably see themselves as energy producers are investing in these things so they can have all the means of production, or are they not?
They're not really. They're investing tiny, tiny percentages of their capex, 1 or 2%. And mostly they're just continuing to do what they know best because they cannot make the same return. They can't make as much money. So their decision has been, we will cling to our existing business model as long as possible. If you look back through history, it's pretty rare for incumbent industries to be the ones that lead you into the next technology. It wasn't the guys who made carriages for horses that figured out how to make cars, you know? And that's because people cling to their old ways of doing things. Meanwhile, you know, sharp-eyed young entrepreneurs are figuring out how to bring us what comes next. And there are lots of them, and this bill will help them. That's the best argument for it. It'll provide them with some of the capital they need to take on these behemoths of I mean, you could almost literally call them dinosaurs, since that's part of what they're digging up to burn.
One more call. Bernadine in Garden City. You're on WNYC with Bill McKibben on our climate story of the week. Hi, Bernadine.
Hello. Big fan of you, Bill, and of you, Brian, as well. Bill, I recently read your book review in the New York Review of Books of Griffin's book, Electrify. And in it, you mentioned that he is not for the development of additional nuclear power plants. And I'm wondering where you stand on that. We've been talking about fossil and about renewables. What about nuclear?
Well, then there's some money in this bill for nuclear power, too. I think we probably should be doing research about new generations of nuclear power. And I think we probably should be keeping open those nuclear power plants that we've already built that we can run safely. But my guess is, Bernadine, that it's going to be a small part of the answer. And the reason has everything to do with money. The price of renewable energy has plummeted in the last decade. It's dropped 90% over 10 years. But the price of nuclear energy has gone up. And that's because it's a, you know, huge centralized production operations. It's possible that as we move at some point to small modular reactors, they'll get cheap enough to compete. But I think my guess is that it's that big nuclear reactor in the sky that's going to be providing most of the energy on which we depend.
We will leave it there. Listeners, now you know more of what's in the, oh, it's not a climate protection bill. I keep forgetting. It's the Inflation Reduction Act that Joe Manchin has now agreed to, but that is a triumph, as Bill McKibben puts it in his New Yorker magazine article, for climate protection, the first major piece of climate legislation in the 34 years since James Hansen of NASA first blew the whistle in this country or sounded the alarm in this country about the global warming that scientists were seeing coming. They have finally broken the logjam. There will be, Bill and other environmentalists say, major emission reductions from this bill, even as it contains the duality that we've been talking about, that it also offers protections to the fossil fuel industry. Bill McKibben is a co-founder of the pro-climate group 350.org, teaches at Middlebury, and is a New Yorker staff writer, where he wrote this up after the Manchin announcement. Bill, we always appreciate it. Thank you so much.
A real pleasure, friend. Take care.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. If you haven't heard this yet, in the last few days, New York City and New York State have both now declared the monkeypox virus a public health emergency. Once the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic and earlier of HIV/AIDS, New York City is now the epicenter of the monkeypox outbreak in this country. In the city, there's been a more than threefold increase in cases over the past 2 weeks, according to reporting from Gothamist, and this is likely an undercount because there remains a lack of testing capacity. So how does this public health emergency declaration change things? What's changed and what hasn't in the care that monkeypox patients are receiving? And how are public health officials messaging against the stigma while prioritizing care for the populations that have so far been disproportionately affected by the virus, queer men? With me now for an update on the monkeypox virus and the official public health response are Joseph Osmundson, a microbiologist, activist, and writer with a PhD in molecular biophysics, and author of the recently published Virology, Essays for the Living, the Dead, and the Small Things in Between. And we also have Jay Varma, physician and epidemiologist, director of the Cornell Center for Pandemic Prevention and Response, and professor of population health sciences at Weill Cornell Medicine. Hi, Dr. Osmundson, Dr. Varma, great to have you both back with us on WNYC.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Dr. Varma, so what does the Public Health Emergency Declaration actually change with respect to the response of both city and state governments?
Yeah, the reason a government does this is really basically for three reasons. And that's true both for here in New York City as well as at New York State. The first is it allows the city to expedite anything it needs related to staff, stuff, or space. So if they need to hire somebody quicker, they can bypass a lot of standard procedures and they can contract quickly for other services. The second thing it does is it allows either the Commissioner of Health or the mayor himself to issue an executive order that may, bypass existing laws. So, like during COVID, for example, you saw that during, limiting hours or capacity at certain facilities. And the third thing it does is raise political awareness. It gets people like WNYC and other people to talk about monkeypox, which is really, absolutely critical in terms of raising awareness, both among people at risk as well as among medical providers.
Most known cases in the state, we should say, are in the five boroughs. So why then, Dr. Varma, did the state declare monkeypox a public health emergency before the city did?
Well, the city and state have, both different authorities as well as different, capacity to deal with certain issues. So, for example, the state, regulates hospitals and all healthcare facilities, like nursing homes. So there may be situations in which the state needs to have this declaration as well if it wants to issue specific guidance or requirements at that level. And the second issue is, of course, there's a lot of inequity in New York State itself. There's a lot of counties outside of New York City that have nowhere near the capacity to, deliver vaccines or conduct testing with outreach simply because they don't have the staff. And so this would allow the state to also help address those counties, which may have the absolute number of cases may be quite small, but it represents a large burden that their health department can't meet.
So listeners, we're going to open up the phones for your participation in this conversation about monkeypox, now officially declared a public health emergency at the New York City level and New York State level. First of all, if you've actually had monkeypox, you want to help us report this story by telling us what you've gone through or are going through or how you managed or are managing and how you cope with the stigma, if that's part of it for you, as well as the effects of the virus physically, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I feel like a lot of the conversation in the media about monkeypox so far has been with public health officials and experts like our guests, and they obviously need to be on and impart their knowledge. But we also need to hear the voices of people who are experiencing this firsthand. We need to hear community voices. We need to hear individual voices. So if you've had monkeypox, or even if you know somebody who's had monkeypox, help us report this story. Tell us what you or the person you know has been going through. How did you manage the physical symptoms? Is there a stigma element that you want to talk about? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. And beyond that, we can just take your monkeypox questions for Joseph Osmundson, again, a microbiologist, activist, and writer with a PhD in molecular biophysics, and Jay Varma, physician and epidemiologist, director of the Cornell Center for Pandemic Prevention and Response, and professor of population health sciences at Weill Cornell Medicine. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Your experiences and questions are invited. So, Dr. Osmundson, is the evidence still indicating that most monkeypox cases are spread by close personal skin-to-skin contact?
Yeah, that is absolutely right. And, I am both a scientist and also a community member. So many people I know are dealing with monkeypox directly or have been exposed and have had to try to find vaccinations. to prevent, hopefully, them getting the illness. And really, New York City and New York State are doing the right thing, but New York City and state cannot procure vaccine. They do not control the national stockpile. They are not the CDC that says how many pages of paperwork a physician has to fill out in order to get someone treatment. They really have no control in terms of regulating the tests for this virus. So we are really arguing that the federal government, who has sort of the most control in New York, but also nationwide, that they need to understand finally that this is a public health emergency, and that when the federal government follows New York City and state in that declaration, will hopefully open up new pathways to test and make treatment and hopefully also vaccination be so much easier, because on the ground, people are still not able to access treatment, and they are not able to access vaccination. And most spread, yes, is still occurring, we think, through very extended skin-to-skin personal contact. And, you know, we can't ask people to not have skin-to-skin contact for weeks and months. People need the tools that the government has, actually, to keep them safer when they have that type of interaction.
Well, is there a kind of safe skin-to-skin contact or safer skin-to-skin contact in the context of monkeypox?
Of course, we are, you know, giving people all of the information that we can in terms of risk reduction and safer interactions, both sexual interactions and non-sexual interactions. You know, we're talking about, you know, at the circuit party, instead of going shirtless, maybe wear a shirt, you know, minimize how much skin you have available. You know, interacting with people sexually on a webcam is the safest way to interact. And then there's gradations all the way down to, you know, the most risky type of in-person interaction is with lots of people and lots of skin touching. So yes, we are asking people to be mindful of risk awareness around the behaviors that, you know, just like with COVID and with HIV, there are steps individuals can take. But we know, based on public health, that asking people to do those harm reduction steps over and over and over again, it's very limited, and people are beautifully imperfect. And we need tools and redundancies such that, you know, a human being's imperfection, it does not land them with a virus.
Let's take a phone call from Jack in Brooklyn, who says he recently recovered from a case. Hi, Jack. You're on WNYC. We really appreciate you calling in.
Hi, Brian. My pleasure. I think you're totally right in saying that hearing voices is important right now. I definitely experienced some excruciating pain, a bit of stigma even within my friend group. And I know that right now the largest piece of recovering and putting together a health plan has been a network of gay friends messaging about vaccine availability, messaging which doctors might be more helpful to get TPOXX medication. And so I'm really grateful for my social sphere, because it was incredibly painful. And, you know, I had to talk to a ton of different doctors about pain medication and sort of exactly what I was going through. And there was sort of a different diagnosis going on, and it was just a really confusing time. And it seems like it sort of sprung up from nowhere, even though we have a lot of models to base things off of in recent history.
When you say different diagnoses going on, were you first diagnosed with something else and then you had to go to another doctor to confirm that it was monkeypox or something like that?
I know a number of my friends initially were told that perhaps they were experiencing a herpes outbreak. So they were prescribed things like Valtrex. And then, you know, overnight that sort of turned into a monkeypox diagnosis. Doctors saying, I think this might be herpes. Never mind, I think this sounds more like monkeypox.
Yeah. And when you talked about suffering some stigma, even in your friends group, can you talk, as it might be useful for people to hear, a little bit of how that played out?
Sure. It was just about sort of once I was in the clear, once, you know, doctors say, once lesions fall off, scab over, and you have new skin growth, you know, I personally only had one pock on my entire body. And once that went away, you know, I was able to go socialize and things, but I experienced some, maybe a bit of judgment in my re-entry to socialization, which was, you know, painful and confusing. I think that we need to do our best to educate, just like we had to do with COVID not so long ago, to make sure that we know the facts that doctors are putting out there, so that we can minimize all of that judgment and not make our friends feel any particular way about re-entering into social, you know, situations.
Jack, we really appreciate your voice. Thank you very much for calling on, and be well. Here's another caller who says he's just recovering from monkeypox, Ed in the Bronx. Ed, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Finally recovering. It's been a rough 2 weeks. Partly because of the limited access or the difficulty in accessing the antiviral TPOX, which could have probably shortened my recovery. It wasn't until I actually got the TPOX last week that I saw significant improvement within 36 hours. The severe pain that I was experiencing for some of the pox and the lesions had gone away. Had I gotten this much sooner, knowing that I was exposed to monkeypox and knowing that I have monkeypox, I think me and many people out there could have just gotten through this much quicker.
What was the cause for the delay in your case, if you can say? Was it that your doctor didn't know about it? Was it the supply wasn't available? Can you say?
Well, it's a combination of a lot of issues. It's a combination of, this is something new for a lot of doctors, and a lot of doctors are not equipped. A lot of medical offices aren't equipped to handle the amount of paperwork that was required up until a little less than 2 weeks ago, when, you can now do it at the back end instead of the front end to get someone approved with medication. So there were a lot of roadblocks, because this was just not having the capacity to dedicate so much time to fill out the paperwork. So we were relegated to offices that, such like places like Callan Lord and Columbia University, where they do have the capacity to handle the paperwork, but at the same time, they were being flooded by people trying to get access to the medication. So there were delays left and right.
And
another thing that I want to add is, that the government really dropped the ball on this with, we knew that the first cases were popping in May. Why did it take so long for them to begin to releasing significant amounts of the vaccine to the general population that was being impacted? We knew that was happening. And here we are now. So there's a lot of suffering, from due to government neglect.
Ed, I appreciate your voice. Thank you very much for sharing your story and your critique of how the government has handled it as well. So, Dr. Varma, let me ask you about one of the things that the first caller said, and that was, well, actually, let me ask you about something that the second caller said about the 36-hour vast improvement time from the time that he was prescribed the medication. Is that your experience? Talk about the effectiveness of the particular medication. Are there multiple medications? What's the best course of treatment if somebody discovers that they have monkeypox?
Yeah, so Brian, thank you for raising that, and thank you to Ed and Jack for sharing their stories. It takes a tremendous amount of courage to acknowledge the suffering you've been through, and we really appreciate that as public health people. The drug that your second caller was referencing, the chemical name is Tecovirimat, but the common name is TPOX. It's actually a really interesting story, and I'll tell it very quickly because it's relevant to the issue here, which is actually that the U.S. government in 2001, because it was concerned about the potential risk of a smallpox bioterrorism attack, kind of mobilized all parts of government, the NIH, the CDC, the Department of Defense, to find a drug that could be used to treat smallpox, because there was never a drug discovered before for this. And they developed TPOX, which, because smallpox and monkeypox are very similar, works very well for monkeypox. Now, because of short-sightedness at that time, the U.S. government approved it only for the treatment of smallpox, even though it was demonstrated in their animal models to be very effective against monkeypox. And as a result, CDC is as the only agency that can release the drug and is releasing it with all this paperwork required. And so many of us, Joe, myself, and tremendous community activists have worked to expedite that. we don't have a really good randomized trial, which is kind of the gold standard. You know, one group has monkeypox and gets the drug, another group has monkeypox and doesn't get the drug. But there's a lot of data from animal models and now from patient experience indicating first that the drug is safe, that it has very few side effects. Second of all, that you can see these kind of very dramatic reduction in pain and discomfort and rapid removal of these lesions very quickly. And that's particularly important, not just because it reduces suffering, but it also reduces the time that people need to isolate. So it's both good for the patient as well as good for us society, because it gets people out and about much faster. So we're hopeful that there's going to be both good research on this, but also really just expanded compassionate use.
And Dr. Osmundson, to one of the things the first caller was talking about, the wariness of his friends to interact in certain ways after he was recovered. Can you talk about the timeline of recovery and immunity? We know with coronavirus in general, once you've had it and in the immediate period after you've recovered from it, you're pretty safe to interact with other people, both for yourself and for them. What's the case with monkeypox?
Yeah, first, I want to echo Jay's comment about Ed and Jack. The thing that I heard from those callers was what we saw with HIV, what we're seeing again now, where a community is being impacted and they feel left behind and they become experts at their own health. You know, hearing Ed and Jack talk, I was hearing specific nods to changes in CDC protocols about TPOC, you know, that as an activist, we've been following, but patients have had to become experts at that level in order to advocate for care for themselves. And it gives me immense pride in my community, but it also makes me so scared and worried that not everyone has the time and capacity to have to do that to get a drug to ease their suffering. I have immense pride for my community at the moment. This is a really long isolation. As Dr. Varma said, folks need to isolate when they're infectious, and that can be for weeks. And so that's another thing that a public health emergency at the federal level can do, is mobilize funds to help people, support people, get the emotional, practical, and financial needs met so they can properly isolate to prevent ongoing spread. Once you're cleared by your doctor and you have that good skin grown underneath the lesions, you are the most immune person in the North American continent to this virus, right? So it's like, in a way, we had this framework shift around HIV in the last decade, where we learned through amazing science that someone who's HIV positive and undetectable actually is the safest sex partner in terms of HIV transmission. They cannot transmit HIV. Whereas if you think you're having sex with someone who's HIV negative, they might not know their status, et cetera. So someone who has just recovered from monkeypox is sort of the most immune, quote unquote, sort of safest, the best.
Good to know. And is there a test to determine that somebody is clear? Is it like a negative COVID test?
There isn't, right? So we have a huge runway ahead of us in terms of diagnostics. The only diagnostics available now are on open lesions. And, frankly, just because someone has the DNA in their saliva does not mean they're infectious. Again, this virus was ignored from 1970 until now. So these fundamental virological questions, is there live virus in saliva? Is there DNA in saliva? What is the pathway to recovery? What are the exact and the total? We don't really understand if saliva and respiratory droplets play a significant role or not. And why do we not understand that? Because until recently, this virus impacted people in a place that we could ignore and forget about and think that it wouldn't impact us. And we could ignore also the suffering of the people in the endemic region. And we're seeing just the global cost of ignoring a preventable infectious disease anywhere on this planet.
Kevin in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I just had a question about how the vaccine eligibility criteria are slated to change under the emergency order. And just a comment on, I think, how restrictive that the criteria have been so far. I think currently you need to be a man who has sex with men with multiple sex partners in the past, I don't know, 2 weeks or something, to be eligible to receive a vaccine. I feel like that's just a very ham-fisted policy decision that leads to some of the stigma that we're talking about. And really doesn't give me that much faith in the government's ability to make this epidemic different from what we saw with COVID.
Wow. Dr. Varma, do you want to confirm or refute those eligibility criteria as Kevin laid them out and comment?
Yeah. So first comment was about whether the eligibility criteria will change. I don't think they will for the near future. Really, right now, there's just simply not enough supply to meet the demand. So the priority at the federal government level, in addition to getting more supply, is to make sure it gets delivered to the people at highest risk. And we know right now that the highest risk group is, you know, gay men and people in their sexual networks. And that's sort of been loosely defined, you know, sort of our written definition is sort of multiple or anonymous sex partners in the last 14 days. You know, I mean, I would say that you know, people are just self-attesting to what their risk is. I wouldn't encourage people to come out there and claim their, because it is unethical, you know, the claim that you're at higher risk than you are. But, you know, there is some nuance in what it means to be at risk. You know, what is the definition of multiple sex partners, for example? But right now it is really a priority that group maintain the priority for getting vaccinated. And then the only other group, that's recommended to get vaccinated is people who are known close contacts. So let's say you're a household member of somebody who's in one of those high-risk groups and has gotten monkeypox.
A few more minutes with Dr. Varma and Dr. Osmundson on what it means that New York City and New York State have declared monkeypox an official public health emergency. And with your monkeypox questions and anecdotes generally, Alex in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alex.
Hi there. Yeah, thanks for this conversation. It's been actually incredibly enlightening. I do have a question. Should gyms that do or athletic facilities that have like a lot of sports with close contact, like wrestling or jujitsu or any of those kind of sports, be taking monkeypox more seriously? I think for context, this isn't really being talked about or taken very seriously at all in those circles, and I'm kind of curious if it should be.
Dr. Varma, should it be?
You know, at this time, there isn't a, you know, the number of people with monkeypox, even though it has grown, you know, substantially, is not a level where I would say that, you know, all gyms need to be implementing, you know, immediate precautions, you know, related to monkeypox. Now, that said, you know, the caller is highlighting an important consideration, and this is very relevant for, you know, back to college and university settings as well, too. You know, we know that diseases that transmit by skin-to-skin contact, such as like MRSA, you know, a skin infection, you have outbreaks in places where people are in close contact, like gyms, wrestling teams, et cetera. So it wouldn't surprise me if there end up being some infections that end up getting transmitted through gyms and saunas and other places like that. I do think that gyms and saunas and places like that should be thinking about kind of what their protocols are going to be for the near future. You know, there's always a benefit to having enhanced cleaning of surfaces in those places, but I don't feel like there need to be specific warnings or business restrictions at this time on those places.
Related question from a listener on Twitter says, how long does the monkeypox virus live on surfaces like doorknobs or grocery packages and products or hotel linen? Dr. Varma, I'll stay with you for that. If it does even live on all of those surfaces that the tweeter referenced.
Yeah, so this is a important question we don't know the exact answer to, but I'll tell you what we do know, and then I'd be happy to see Joe, since he's a, you know, a basic scientist and works on these viruses, maybe, you know, chime in as well. What we do know is that, you know, this virus can survive on the surfaces around a patient and particularly on the clothing, towels, linens, et cetera, that a person uses. And this is based on epidemiologic investigations in Central and West Africa, where the disease has historically been localized to. But we don't know, because those studies were never done in sort of exhaustive detail, to figure out how long it survives And it's particularly challenging, even if you can detect the virus on a surface, to know, is it actually infectious to other people? You know, a lot of people are asking the same questions, for example, about COVID. So the current recommendation is that, you know, any surfaces that you use in your home or any utensils should be washed thoroughly. You can use a dilute bleach, or you can use an alcohol-based solution, or even just vigorous scrubbing with hot soap and water. And that your linens and things should be washed in a washing machine. And if it's a proper washing machine, that should disinfect them. But we don't really know the answer whether it's hours or days that you're at risk of getting infection if none of those surfaces are cleaned.
Did you want to add anything, Dr. Edmondson?
Yeah, I do. You know, it's remarkable how little we know. You know, the pox viruses are robust viruses. They tend, you know, we know, unlike COVID, where we really thought fomite might play a role, and it turns out largely no. Here's a virus where epidemiologically we know that surfaces can play a role. You know, I mean, thinking about very early on in COVID, I think in March, a preprint came out on the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which was a novel virus. It did not exist on the planet before, you know, the 6 months prior to the pandemic, showing the durability of the virus on different surfaces for different amounts of time using really good virological methods. We still don't have that for this virus that's been described in humans since 1970. And I just cannot help but believe that's because largely the people impacted before now were in Central and West Africa, and the people largely being impacted now are queer men in our sexual network. You know, the WHO said, the panel that recommended against declaring this a public health emergency of international concern, literally said, oh, it's just affecting gay men, and therefore it's not yet an emergency. You know, and before it was just affecting people in Central and West Africa, and therefore it's not an emergency. And this affects what virological questions we ask and answer. How has no one published the surface durability of this virus using best virological practice? It astonishes me, the lack of basic virological knowledge we have. And I cannot help but believe it's because of the communities largely impacted so far.
So lastly, Dr. Osmondson, let's talk about the public health messaging here for just a second. That is, so far, how are public health officials weighing the need for destigmatizing responses, and how do you recommend that they do, while also recognizing that certain groups have been disproportionately affected by monkeypox? Even the term men who have sex with men sounds sort of clunky, plus it could lead to some missed diagnoses because some trans and non-binary folks aren't really included in it. In fact, I'll also read a tweet that just came in from a listener who says to not forget that transgender, gender nonconforming, or gender non-binary people are also eligible for the monkeypox vaccine, not just men. But Dr. Osmondson, how do they strike the balance? How should they strike the balance?
Yeah, we're talking about behaviors and risk, not identities. So you'll notice Jay and I have not been saying men who have sex with men. We've been saying gay men or queer people and our sexual network, which better describes the lay of the land. When I open up Grindr on my phone, I don't just see men, right? I see people of different genders, and increasingly so. And that is something my community is really proud of, and I think we've been doing better on, and the public health community needs to catch up to where we're at and make sure that trans women and non-binary people know that they have access to vaccine. And when they go try to get vaccine, you know, that they do not have any issues in that line or with their healthcare provider. Look, the messaging here is so difficult. And we are in a world with increased institutional homophobia and transphobia. We see legislative pushbacks on our ability to exist in public in many places. You know, and so, but at the same time, my community's health is the first thing on my mind. And I'm not worried about not being honest with my community about different risk factors because of what some sort of a fascist Republican type pushback against queer people's ability to exist. We need to be very clear and honest and direct, you know, for community, by community. That's why I'm so glad we've heard from someone, you know, me and the other callers who are in the community affected. We need to be left to talk to our community about what's risk. And then the other thing is our government needs to show up because we have need. You know, people wanted to get vaccinated before Pride, and the federal government did not let that happen. You know, gay folks are not driving this epidemic. A global lack of access to healthcare is driving this epidemic. And we need to be very clear that gay sex is a thing that has always existed and will always exist. People deserve the tools to enjoy the type of sex that they like without risk of infectious disease. And we have those tools with this epidemic. And it is a crime that people have not been able to access those tools.
And I said that was going to be the last question, but some tweets have just come in that I want to reference because I think they're interesting and important. Someone writes, while vaccination appointments are extremely limited in New York City, neighboring county health departments have vaccine clinics with minimal waiting time. So if that's true, posted by somebody who's tweeting as fam doc, as in family doctor. That's good information for people. And Dr. Varma, one for you from a listener who asks, is it,
Can I hop in on the previous question just really quick?
Yes, you may.
So that is true. We've seen Westchester County and places on Long Island have vaccine appointments when no one could get them in New York. The question is, who in New York City has the privilege, the access, the ability to take off work, to get up to Westchester, to pay for the Long Island Railroad, to pay for the cab to the county health place and to actually access that vaccine? So, you know, we know that that's true, but that really disproportionately helps a certain type of person.
Dr. Varma, listener writes, I am a licensed massage therapist in Manhattan. I am up to my elbows in multiple naked people 5 days a week. Why is the monkeypox vaccine not available to those in my profession?
Yeah, no, it's an important question because it also relates to why the monkeypox vaccine isn't being provided routinely to healthcare workers as well. You know, normally when we have a new infectious disease, when we have a new outbreak of a disease, healthcare workers are at high risk and they often get prioritized as well. And the reason is fundamentally because there just isn't enough supply. You know, if there was enough supply, then people who come into close skin-to-skin contact with, you know, potentially with monkeypox patients should be eligible. So fundamentally, it's a supply question. Then when you look at, okay, well, we have a limited supply, who do we prioritize it to? We have to go with what we know. And the reality is both here in the United States and globally, this outbreak is so tightly linked right now to gay men and their sexual health networks, as well as their household contacts, that is where the limited supply has to go.
So,
it's not just, but that's what we're left with.
So 10 seconds, how will we get to sufficient supply for everybody who wants one?
You know, it's going to take some time. This is a vaccine that has not grown very quickly, and the U.S. fell behind on it. So it's one of the reasons I would really push for people to also understand the purpose of screening, how to look at your skin, educate yourself, and also try to access testing whenever possible, because we're going to be in this for some time.
Jay Varma, physician and epidemiologist, director of the Cornell Center for Pandemic Prevention and Response, and professor of population health sciences at Weill Cornell Medicine, and Joseph Osmundson, microbiologist, activist, writer with a PhD in molecular biophysics. And wait, I'm going to find your book title again, because how could I let you go without one more time citing your book title? It's Virology, Essays for the Living, the Dead, and the Small Things in Between. Unforgettable. Doctors, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Our next guest has a new memoir that serves as part personal journey, part historical deep dive into New York City's Chinese community. In his new book, Our Laundry, Our Town, My Chinese American Life from Flushing to the Downtown Stage and Beyond. Playwright Alvin Ng shares his memories growing up in Flushing when his family was just one of very few Chinese immigrant families living in the neighborhood. He chronicles his journey from his upbringing in and around his family's hand laundry to his life and career as a playwright. And what he shares will resonate with many of you listening now, no doubt the familiar story of coming from an immigrant family and growing up in New York City, feeling both inspired by the bustle around you while also feeling alone or like an outsider. The title of his memoir is also a nod to Thornton Wilder's 1930s play, Our Town. Again, it's Our Laundry, Our Town, My Chinese American Life from Flushing to the Downtown Stage and Beyond. Alvin Ng, thank you for joining us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
So the title of your memoir, like I said, is a nod to Thornton Wilder's 1938 play, Our Town. What's the connection?
Yes, actually, Our Town has a lot of Chinese influence. Like when I was getting ready to teach a class on it, I researched it and found that Thornton Wilder's father was consul general to both Hong Kong and Shanghai. So as a result, Thornton spent a lot of his childhood in China. And then there's a great collection of letters between him and Gertrude Stein. I love that she calls him Thorny, as only she can, dear Thorny. But he says, I'm taking all the ideas from your Making of Americans, as well as the concept of the property manager from Chinese opera. And that became the stage manager in Our Town. And then she realized that, you know, as growing up, as you've said, like as a child of immigrants, we're always looking for like American frames of reference. And then to think that perhaps the most Americana play has a lot of Chinese influence really, really, really rocked my world. And then my wife and I did a residency in Hong Kong where we taught Our Town to the Hong Kong students and told them about the Chinese influence. They immediately recognized how, just like Chinese opera, it deals more with the spirit world than the mortal world. But they had a funny observation. They asked, are those families in Grover's Corners, are they from arranged marriages too?
And on the spirit world element of that, I want to read the very first sentence of your memoir. And it kind of makes a segue from our last segment about homelessness in New York. It says, you write, while I have been blessed to have always had a roof over my head and the honor of living with loved ones, when I was growing up, homelessness was a constant spiritual state. That's fascinating. Explain that. How is homelessness a constant spiritual state for you as a kid when you always had a roof over your head?
Well, that's true. Well, again, we're very lucky and blessed to always be housed, but yet I never felt really completely at home anywhere, like just trying to find your place to fit in. And it always was only to a certain point. I'm not saying I was shunned everywhere, but it was almost like you can never find full acceptance, fully be at home as a child. But then I was very lucky that in my teenage years, the punk rock scene developed in New York City, and suddenly all the outsiders were in there, if you will, like, and we all celebrated our differences and shouted our differences to the rooftops. So it that changed. But as a child, it was very hard to find a place where I felt at home.
And you wrote, in my teenage high school years, two words, Chinese rocks, wreaked havoc on my existence. This havoc also had historical precedents globally and personally that I am still processing. Chinese Rocks is a song by the legendary Ramones, who are also Queens kids, I might add, like you and me. Can you elaborate on that passage?
Yes, absolutely. And also, it was also done by the Ramones and one other Queens punk kid, Johnny Thunder's band, The Heartbreakers. They co-wrote it and did that. And yes, when I finally found my place in the punk rock world, I thought, oh, this is great. I fit in. I don't have to think about how different I am now. But then just even seeing that song title, Chinese Rocks, shook me up. I was like, oh, no, wait a minute. I thought I was in a place now where I didn't have to deal with that anymore. But of course, I was wrong. You've always got to process that and really, you know, make peace with your identity. And so that freaked me out. But then when I finally listened to the song, I realized, oh, my God, it's all about Dee Dee Ramone and Johnny Thunders wanting to score some heroin, some China white heroin. And then it made me think much later on a much deeper level, like growing up in the 70s, like so many of us, and we just idolized the heroin chic junkie. But then I looked at the impact of opium on the Chinese diaspora from the Opium Wars. And then within my own family, my grandfather was an opium overdose. And I said, this is very different. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very different. And yet, despite the sort of it sounds like anti-Chinese hostility implied in that Ramon song. To this day, music and kind of punk music like that remains a big part of your life. I think you call yourself an acoustic punk raconteur, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I feel like if you're not a trained musician, not a trained actor, that is your lane. That sums up an acoustic punk raconteur. And it's all coming together with a newer piece I'm working on now called Here Comes Johnny Yen Again, which is that's actually the first line from the Iggy Pop David Bowie song Lust for Life. And it explores deeper where a lot of the Our Laundry, Our Town looks at my parents' journey. In many ways now, this is looking at my grandfather's journey and how he was an opium addict. And I'm looking into how that, and just juxtaposing that with growing up in the 70s and loving heroin chic junkie. And well, we'll be doing a some of this in October as part of an mm-hmm. overall event where New York and Asian American artists respond to the 20th anniversary of the Hong Kong handover. And that's and how that, you know, to me, my way into that was the key concession of the Opium Wars was the ceding of Hong Kong from China to Britain. And then in 97, it was returned back to China. And so we're looking at how that really impacted immigration to New York in particular from that, and also how it impacted the Chinese diaspora. And that's going to be October 14th at the Church Street School of Music in Tribeca.
And what a road for people of Hong Kong, right? From being under British colonialism to being under Chinese authoritarianism.
Absolutely. That's why it was fascinating when my wife, Wendy Wasdahl, and I were doing our workshop in Hong Kong. It was fascinating to talk to the young people. Sadly, they much preferred UK rule to China rule. Of course, I wish that it wasn't just that binary. Of course, I wish they could rule themselves. But it was very fascinating, especially like here we are too. We're a former British colony too. So
we will look for that in October for sure. And yes, this is the 25th anniversary. That was 1997 that Hong Kong got turned over back to China, and then for a while anyway, had a modicum of independence. Listeners, we want to open up the phones. I wonder if any Chinese Americans specifically are listening, and if Alvin Ng's story resonates with you. Listeners who came from specifically Chinese immigrant families or immigrants yourselves, I'm curious if you're relating to this. Did you also feel like an outsider, spiritually homeless, even if you had a roof over your head? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Did your parents also have a hand laundry, as some Chinese American families did at one time? 212-433-9692 for Alvin, who's the author now of Our Laundry, Our Town, My Chinese American Life from Flushing to the Downtown Stage and Beyond, or maybe you know some of his plays. You link your family's laundry to what you call the long chain of Chinese American resistance in 20th century New York City. And that jumped out at me because, well, I guess, you know, I grew up just a few miles from you, but in a mostly white neighborhood, and there was a Chinese hand laundry that my parents sometimes brought clothes to. And the last thing that I associated it with, even as I started to become politically aware, was it being a form of anything linked to resistance. So talk about that link between a Chinese hand laundry that your parents had and Chinese American resistance in the history of New York City.
Absolutely. They were able to thrive, like the laundry in my neighborhood in Flushing and yours a few miles away in Bayside, because of a group called the Chinese Hand Laundry Alliance. That was in the 1930s. And it also grew out of that whole, like, even before that, like, as Chinese immigration was really getting to be a threat in some circles. Like, it started off with the first and, God help us, the last American law that made it illegal for one race of people to become citizens here with the Chinese Exclusion Act. And that grew out of all the fear in the late 19th century. And the gold rush at that time, suddenly the license to mine gold was so much more expensive for Chinese. And then they tried to do that same thing with the laundries in early 20th century New York City, where all of a sudden it became astronomical for the licenses for Chinese hand laundry people. And so this time they stood together, they bonded together, and they fought it. So in many ways it was one of the first labor movements for Chinese Americans, was the Chinese Hand Laundry Alliance. And they paved the way for my parents, because then after that became McCarthyism. And I learned a lot, like growing up, also talked about being spiritually homeless. Growing up as a kid, I thought, well, how come my parents don't know anyone? They never attend PTA meetings, and they only socialize with other Chinese hand laundry families and relatives. And on one level, there was a language thing where only my father learned to speak fluent English. My mother spoke very little English. But then as I got older, I realized, well, they were raised under the cloud of the Chinese Exclusion Act and of McCarthyism. So they really had to lay low to really to not be caught, essentially. So that's how it affected me. And I realized it affected us for good and for worse, like thankfully with the Chinese Hand Laundry Alliance, that showed that we belonged here. That was a stand where that paved the way for my parents. But yet, even though we were there physically, we weren't there in every way. But it's funny how things change now, too. There's a lot more visibility for these things. Like right now at the Museum of the City of New York, they've added a gallery about the Chinese Hand Laundry Alliance to their ongoing show called Raise Your Voice about New York City activism. So there's been a lot of amazing confluences around the release of my book and what's been going on in the city and the world. So that's just one of the positive ones.
Yeah, one of the lines from your book, the cleaned garments wrapped up in these packages were the silent witnesses to the events and rituals that made up the lives of their wearers. So did you and your parents speculate about the lives of the mostly not Chinese people who were bringing their clothes there?
I definitely did. I wrote about that too, where I would imagine that if you remember the old hand laundries, they're primarily like these brown wrapped packages with all these mm-hmm. different colored tickets on the walls. And to me, that always made look like a big apartment building to me. And I imagine I called it the Great Wall of Laundry. And I imagined wow, where are these packages going? Because, unfortunately, my parents had a very turbulent arranged marriage. So that's why another thing in the 70s, while New York was going through extreme changes and getting really wild in so many ways, I would go home to a household that was not just rooted in a different culture, but almost rooted in a different century because I had an arranged marriage. So I always assumed, they worked hard. They worked 12 hours a day, six days a week. And I always assumed that the people who could afford to have other people clean their laundry and have it pressed, they must have lived on easy streets. So I imagine, wow, these garments I'm wrapping up, the lives, they must be going home to people that have these perfect lives.
Did your mother, do you have any recollection, since it was the 1970s, express any awareness of the feminist movement that was breaking out around her as she was in this arrangement? And maybe she liked the arranged marriage, I don't know. But they're kind of so opposite, right?
Oh, no, it really was. In some ways, too, she was always a very strong woman. And a lot of... and we're Toissanese, which is almost like the Sicilians. We're from the south, and there was a big pipeline from Toissan to Hong Kong to New York City for immigration. We were the primary people who ran the Chinatowns in the 19th and 20th century. So my mother was very independent always. Like, my parents had an arranged marriage, and then my father came here first. He started working in Chinatown restaurants and became, by the village standards, a rich man. So he went back. They had the arranged marriage, and then my mother did not see or hear from him for 10 years. So through village contact, she came on her own as a paper wife, meaning she had a false identification papers to come here to find him. So she was very independent, very strong already.
Alvin Ng with us, his new book, Our Laundry, Our Town, My Chinese American Life from Flushing to the Downtown Stage and Beyond. And Julie in Port Washington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much for doing this segment. This is my first time calling in, and thanks to you with the pandemic, I've been listening to your show.
And, thank you so much.
So many things that he's talking about, I identify. My parents came here from China, and they have encountered a lot of the issues that Mr. Wong is talking about. My father came as a paper son, and there were a lot of things that was involved with, we're like outsiders. Even though I was born in this country, we stayed to ourselves. Chinatown was a little bit better, but when we moved out to Flushing, it was a little bit harder, because we were different. So I really appreciate he talking about that. I don't think people think about that history that much. And I wish there were more discussion in the school system about what the immigrants, especially Chinese immigrants, have to go through. So I'm really appreciative of what you have, what you're doing. And I'm always afraid of calling because I feel like, well, you're not going to listen to me because I'm not Caucasian or anything like that. So thank you very much for doing it. And I really truly identify everything. Downtown Flushing at that time was kind of mostly Caucasian. I always remember the RKO theater there. That's now kind of, right? It's, I don't know what's going on down there, but Flushing has changed so much, and there's a lot more Asians than when I moved in 1970. So that thank you very old, much.
Thank you, Julie. That Grand Ole Theater, the RKO Keith, where my parents would take me sometimes if we wanted to see something on a really big screen. I don't know what the state of it is today. But Alvin, what are you thinking listening to Julie?
No, absolutely. It's huge. Flushing's changed so much. Like the section of Flushing I grew up in was actually very Jewish and Italian. Like I always joke that every Saturday in the eighth grade, I was dancing the horror at a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah every Saturday. And yet, it was very different then. We were one of the few Chinese families there. And now it's become like a real physical, metaphorical center of the Chinese community, like Flushing. Of course, Manhattan's Chinatown and Sunset Park, and it's very different there. We're talking about feeling spiritually homeless, like and just what Julie said, like we felt like no one would listen to us, and that still pervades in us as adults some ways too. But that's why, in some ways, we with all the anti-Asian hate crimes for the past few years, we actually have more of a voice than we ever had. It's really created ways for us to speak out, and I feel like I just love that there's so much more support from different communities. Like I do a lot of activist work with a group called Rise and Resist. We do a lot of immigrant activism. So there's a support coming from so many different angles from there. And like, I do a lot of work with the folklore group City Lore, and they sponsored a 40th anniversary of the Chinatown Garment Workers Alliance. So that's another point of Chinese American resistance. So it's great. And then what's happening to the city of New York? It's great that there's a lot more support and interest. And so, because of all the heinous crimes, I think we've never had a stronger voice on the streets and on these stages and screens. That's why I think that's been a great way to fight back, if you will.
And Julia mentioned there should be more education in the schools. I know that there's a movement that has broken out right now, I think really become more prominent because of the recent rash of hate crimes, to require some Asian American history to be taught in the public schools in New York State. So we will see if that gets enshrined. And Julie, you're always welcome here. Call us again. Eugene and Nyack, you're on WNYC. Hi, Eugene.
Hello. I just wanted to. I'm really excited to learn more about Alvin. I grew up in the Midwest in the '80s, and I was really into the hardcore scene and the punk rock scene and the skate scene. There were no real role models, especially like in athletics. So you didn't have someone in society to really look up to. There were skateboarders that were Asian that were on top, Christian Hsoy, and he listened to a lot of like LA punk. And there are a couple bands, Bitch Magnet and the Marginal Men from DC, and they had Asian, you know, guitar players, and it was just helped me gain confidence in playing in a band and especially in the Midwest because it's so homogenous. But in that book, Please Kill Me, about the 70s punk rock scene, there was a woman, I forgot her name, but she was Chinese and she was like a sort of like a groupie. But, you know, another, you know, key figure in that scene. But anyway,
Alvin, you want to talk to Eugene at all?
Sure, Eugene. Yeah, though. Thanks for calling. Yes, there were not a lot of Asian Americans in the punk world. There was some, but and I tell more in the 70s world too, where I think some people you're talking about, they were more on the side, but on the stage there wasn't as much. That's why we were always looking for things like even like when I did Here Comes Johnny Yen Again, I first thought, Johnny Yen, is that a Chinese character? Could that be? But that's actually the Iggy Pop David Bowie song is based on the William S. Burroughs character, Johnny Yen. So, no, there were not a lot of that. So that's why, you know, we all come into a different angles. Again, that's when I first even heard about the song Chinese Rocks. So I was freaked out. But Maybe you found this too, but I felt despite that there weren't a lot of Asian Americans in the punk scene, that just being there was a world where we were all celebrating our differences. I felt like all the misfits fit in there.
Yeah. Like if you were a skateboarder, you're just like part of this army of, you know, like misfits. And that's when I was 16, that's when I really sort of felt comfortable in a social scene. So anyways,
right.
I don't know if you had really interesting.
Great. Thank you.
Go ahead, Alvin.
Yes, and also, I don't know if you had the, you know, having immigrant parents, that in some ways that helped ground me too. Like when I first started painting my fingernails black, like the punk bands, like Freddie Mercury in particular, I would go home and my mother would see my black fingernails and she would just say, ha ha ha, Batman. So it was good to have that grounding in some ways too.
So, and Eugene, thanks so much for your call. Call us again. Does this relate to sort of the second half of the title of your book? That is how you eventually wound up in the downtown Manhattan theater scene and being a playwright, and then we're out of time.
Okay, yes, it did. It did lead to that, like, really, two things that happened. A person that changed my life then and now was David Johansen. He let me interview him when I was writing for the Flushing High School paper, The Forum. Huh. Then years later, he actually introduced me to Rise and Resist. But then it came time to tell our stories, and I found that also inspired by Our Town, I started doing a piece called The Last Emperor of Flushing, places like Dixon Place and the Pan Asia Repertory Theater, and even at the Queen State in the Park. So that really, theater was a place where, like where you find yourself in. And luckily seeing the late 70s, early 80s punk performance art people like Holly Hughes, Ethel Eichelberger, people like that, where I said, wow, there's a place for this crazy punk rock energy in a place besides a 2-minute song. So that was a great thing that led to more theater. And also, I think I have more facility with words than music. I love my 2.5 chords, but I have more facility with words.
As displayed in the conversation, which is now ending, with Alvin Eng, E-N-G. His new book is Our Laundry, Our Town, My Chinese American Life from Flushing to the Downtown Stage and Beyond. So great to have you on, Alvin. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. Great to share this with another Queens guy. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.